The Bane Free Radio Hour.
On the podcast, shoe store mix of new Velcro with quantum entanglement pops man's sneakers to Japan and Antarctica simultaneously, and him onto page 57 of the Gazetteer of Iowa. Backward sparks and haunted harks. Plus, we continue with the complete audiobook serialization of Alliance of Equals by Sharon Lee and Steve Miller. All right now. Welcome to the Bane Free Radio Hour podcast. It's an honor to have you along. I'm Bane, Senior Editor Tony Daniel. Hey, we have Gorg Huff and Paula Goodlett once again with us to discuss the latest entry in the Ring of Fire series, 1637, The Volga Rules, by Eric Flint, Paula Goodlett, and Gorg Huff. This is part two of our interview with Paula and Gorg. The Volga Rules is one of the Northern Crescent Ring of Fire stories, and it is the follow-up to the really fun Ring of Fire novel 1636 The Kremlin Games that Paula, Gorg, and Eric also wrote together. So the conclusion of that interview is coming up. And we continue with the complete audiobook serialization of Sharon Lee and Steve Miller's Liaden Universe novel Alliance of Equals. First, here's the news. Look to the sky. No, the sky in your mind. See that beautiful object approaching? Yep, it's the February E-Arcs, now at Bane eBooks. Now, an E-Arc is actually not an object itself, but the wave interference patterns that reading a book and thinking about doing your taxes produces on your mental pond. Hey, look, reading the book actually cancels out the peaks of time anxiety and heightens the crest of expected returns. Okay, that is possibly not right. Actually, an eARC is an electronic advanced reader copy of a book that will be coming out in print and ebook form about 2 to 3 months from now. We will sell this to you in all its unproof red glory at Bane eBooks so that you can experience the work of some really great authors as early as possible and get the latest book in your favorite series. Available now at Bane eBooks is Uncharted by Kevin J. Anderson and Sarah A. Hoyt. It's 1803, a new 1803. Young Meriwether Lewis, footloose and intrigue, goes to hear a lecture in St. Louis by the venerated old wizard Benjamin Franklin. Franklin's talk is disrupted by an attack of a winged, fire-breathing beast. In the aftermath, Franklin tells the young man that he knows of a great growing evil that lurks in the uncharted arcane territories west of the Mississippi. Using his own vast fortune, Franklin commissions Lewis and his partner William Clark to embark on a voyage of exploration, accompanied by the brilliant shape-shifting sorceress Sacagawea. Lewis and Clark set out on an unparalleled adventure filled with muskets and magic. Also out this month is Oblivion, the 8th entry in the Starfire series. The war with the Arduans has ended, and the Arduans have come to call humanity their allies, most of them. The Arduan warrior caste refuses to accept defeat. Now known as the Kaituni, they are waging a war of extermination against all members of the Pan-Sentient Union. What's more, the Kaituni have an unexpected weapon in their arsenal, the alien arachnids, once thought driven to extinction. The odds look bleak, but Admiral Ian Trevane and Commodore Ossian Weathermore have faced down long odds in the past. Now it's time to take a stand for Earth, for humanity, for the Pan-Sentient Union. Uncharted by Kevin J. Anderson and Sarah A. Hoyt, and Oblivion by Steve White and Charles E. Gannon are available now in eARC form at Bane eBooks. They won't be available after the eBooks are out in May, so check them out. This is part two of a two-part interview with Gorg Huff and Paula Goodlett, talking about 1637 The Volga Rules by Eric Flint, Paula Goodlett, and Gorg Huff. Part one is available on last week's podcast. I want to welcome Paula Goodlett and Gorg Huff to the podcast. Hello, folks.
Hi.
Hello.
Paula Goodlett is the editor emeritus now of the Grantville Gazette. She's moved on to a far more exciting life. But she's highly involved with Eric Flint's Ring of Fire series, always has been. Since it's an inception of the 1632 community and such at 1632.org. She and her husband currently live in Florida, enjoying the lack of snow
although I hear they had a cold snap. Gorg Huff is a Texas citizen who has now moved to the cold north of the Midwest, who has enthusiastically helped in researching the Ring of Fire series background, written numerous stories for the Grantville Gazettes, and contributed both maps and drawings to 1634, the Bavarian Crisis. With Eric Flint and Paula Goodlett, he is the author of The Alexander Inheritance, a really cool sort of Ring of Fire, perhaps, offshoot. And Ring of Fire series entries, 1636, The Viennese Waltz, and 1636, The Kremlin Games. Out now at booksellers everywhere is 1637, The Volga Rules. Before we go any farther, we should, for those who don't know, the Ring of Fire books are about a town from West Virginia from about the year 2000, got thrown back in time and out of place into the middle of what will be Germany, in the middle of the continental Europe in 1632. And now we are at 1637. The world is, that world is reacting to the fact that, these people from the future have shown up. So this guy, Bernie Zeppi, he's gone up to Russia. He's from our time, which means an uptimer, they call them. And that was a lot of what set off the Kremlin game.
The Dacha had bunches and bunches of bright people, and then all this information coming in from the Ring of Fire, and you get a guy who loves the idea of flight and has studied natural philosophy, which is what they called science at the time, and trying to figure out how they could make things fly. And he's asking Bernie questions, and he's asking other people questions, and he's trying to figure out what lift means in the 17th century, and that different gases have different weights, and that weight itself, getting an understanding of what weight is, that is closer to the 20th century understanding than the 15th century understanding that was actually more prevalent in Russia at the time. And he gets it, so he learns how to build a dirigible, learns how to build a hot air balloon. And from a hot air balloon, he learns how to build a hydrogen balloon. And they experiment and they try things. And occasionally people die in the process. They make a new kind of gun. And a lot of the people involved in the making of that new kind of gun die when little parts of the gun explode and kill them. Because the guy who, not everybody who is smart is nice. And the guy who invents this new kind of gun in Russia is a very smart man, but not a very nice man, and he honestly doesn't give a shit how many people he kills in the doing of it. Mm-hmm. So you get a lot of people from that particular, from the gun shop, running east to join the Tsar. I mean, can you blame them?
What was they? They've got some steam stuff going on too, as well, right? The
steam engines are actually pretty simple. Knowing that they work is probably the biggest key. There are other keys, things like how much the valve, how tight the valving has to be. You can't open the valves all the way. You open them just a little bit, and the steam rushes out. But these kind of technical details, a lot of those are available from Grantville. They just need to be translated. So steam was something that they could do, and once you get a steam engine, you put it on a boat on the Volga or one of its tributaries, and it will pay for itself in one trip. Because without it, you've got 60 guys with ropes tied to their backs pulling that boat upriver. And even if you're not paying them much, and they didn't pay them much at all, you still got to feed them, and that's expensive. A steam engine will pay for itself in one trip.
Airships, there are lots of dirigible in this Ring of Fire entry. Now, Eric has sort of held back on letting there be too many Zeppelins around, but he kind of let y'all go with
Well, we didn't go that much. There were.
How do they work? How are they used here?
We only had two.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, they seem to be flying around a lot of places.
And we one of them got killed in the test bed. We found it, at Gorg.
That went
and
down
then,
in Kremlin.
In Volga. Yeah, and in Volga.
In Volga, two boats. They built two large dirigibles, both of which went down. One of them simply crashed through weather, and the other one was shot down. They flew around quite a bit before they got shot down, but.
What's the speed difference between trying to go somewhere in this sort of trackless waste and having a dirigible to take you? I mean, it's pretty great.
Oh, it's inconceivable. A dirigible is going to be traveling at 40 to 60 miles an hour, a steam-powered dirigible. An individual is going to be traveling maybe 40 miles a day if he's lucky. More likely, it's going to be 10 to 15 miles a day. If you're talking about a large group, it's going to be 5 to 10 miles a day. So moving an army to Ufa takes forever. Getting a small group of people to Ufa on a dirigible takes about 4 hours.
Mm-hmm. And there's one trip from Russia to, I think it was to Grantville, that like took a day and a half or something because they got really good winds. Am I remembering that right?
Yeah.
There was one 1,500-mile trip that was like, you know, it would have taken half a lifetime maybe for somebody on the ground.
Right. Yeah. That's basically they take it. They take the dirigible from Ufa to the Baltic coast, and it's close to 1,500 miles with the wind taking them out of their way a bit. But they do have to stop for more fuel to keep the hot air part of the lift system and to power the steam engine. And then from there, they go on to, well, a little later in the book, they go on and try to go to Germany, but don't quite make it all the way.
Yeah.
The Passover Pope.
In Grantville, there is another Russian. That's Vladimir. And he's married Brandy. I think their last name is Gorchikov. And what is he? He's sort of an ambassador there, but he's gotten in touch with this guy, Ron Stone, who's got rather large resources of a industrial variety. What sort of plan are they concocting there?
Yes. The steam-powered amphibious ship that uses steam-powered treads both to propel it through the water and to let it climb up onto the ice and function as something between an ice breaker and a very slow ice cart. It's one of those places where you get a group of downtimers looking at uptime technology, basically the technology of a snowmobile combined with the technology of a tank combined with the technology of a ship, and saying, well, why can't we put this together? And in this case, it sort of worked. It didn't really work, but it sort of worked, and it leads the way to something that might work with a few more generations of try it and see. Because when you take two different kinds of technology, two different ways of looking at the world, and start combining them, you get weird stuff.
Well, let's talk about the social relationships for a minute between Vladimir and Brandy, and between uptimers and downtimers when they get together. Bernie has got a thing going with the Tsar's sister, right?
With Vladimir's sister.
Vladimir's sister, sorry. And Brandy is a... Yeah. She's an uptimer, right? She's from our time.
Yeah.
Right.
So how do they cope with this huge cultural difference in these cases? What do they do? I know it's individual.
It is individual. It varies with the individual. In the case of Vladimir and Natasha, who are both members of the very upper nobility of Russia, they are princes. They are Kazan is, I think, the Russian word. Not Kazan. No, it's not. I can't remember the Russian word, but it translates to prince roughly. Basically, it means that their ancestors a few generations back ruled independent territories. They have very high status. Nobody is sure how to deal in the Ring of Fire. Nobody's really sure how to deal with the uptimers. For instance, you get the Count of Narnia, which who isn't actually an uptimer but is getting ready to marry one. You get different ways for the nobility to deal with uptimers because they don't fit the downtime schedules. And in Russia, there's a bit more of a, we can't let these people in because they're not nobility. The Russians would be okay with a Russian prince or princess marrying, say, an English count or earl, but an uptimer, that's too much like a peasant. And the Russians really were very class-oriented. They were the only nation I'm aware of in Europe at the time where the laws were actually specifically different. The penalty for raping a peasant woman was much less. It was essentially a fine. The penalty for raping a noble woman was execution. The laws actually differentiated between the class of people, the level of punishment. Hmm. Murdering a peasant was a lesser crime. Murdering a member of the Streltsy, a greater one. Murdering a member of the service nobility is still a greater one. Murdering a prince, a much greater one. They actually had codified into their laws this monstrous, and it really was monstrous, distinction between people and what rights people had.
Yeah, but on the other side, you have somebody like Brandy, who is an equal rights modern woman who falls for this Russian dude. How do they work that out between them? Who has to adapt to what?
Honestly, in the case of Brandy and Vladimir, Vladimir's already leaning toward Brandy's viewpoint. And they do end up having to compromise, but it's more Vladimir saying, look, I agree with you, but we can't get it done yet. They had to jump through a bunch of hoops in Kremlin games just to get married. And Brandy is sort of being forced to accept the fact that she can't change it all at once, but she never gives up on changing it. And Vladimir sort of is the person who somewhat unwillingly is telling her you can't change it all at once. He knows they have to change. He knows that, but the truth is, if you look at our founding fathers, they knew, Jefferson, Washington, knew slavery was a bad idea. They wanted to get rid of it, but they couldn't figure out how. Washington managed to free his slaves. Jefferson didn't even manage to free his personal slaves. They were all unsuccessful in getting rid of it. Brandy, Bernie, the uptimers in general are not able can't. There's only so far you can push Russia, and they push it too far. That's what happens in Kremlin games, and what leads to the split, because part of Russia simply cannot take that level of change.
So
that brings open war.
Yeah, and speaking of that war, what would a major engagement? All right, so we've got. We got these guns that they're starting to manufacture that you're calling AK-2s and AKs 2.5 and 3.
3.5 and the 4.5. Yeah. Basically what they are is they're a long metal tube just like any gun, but they have basically a very short metal tube with a hole in one side that you can put a cap or put it in so you can run a flintlock, and the tube is made of iron, and it's thick, enough to act as a barrel, and it's pressed up into the long tube of the rifle, giving you effectively a removable, reloadable cartridge that won't blow up, and it's called a chamber loading. Flintlock is the AK 2.2 and 3, and then a chamber loading cap lock are the later models once they get some cap production. But the big problem for the cap locks is the cap production. They can make fulminated mercury, they can make the new stuff that I can never remember the name of. But they can't make it in quantities enough to feed an army. So they're still, these are basically flintlocks, but they're flintlocks where you can take off the back couple of inches of the barrel, make several copies of the back several inches of the barrel, load them all up, pull one out, put another one in. And that makes it not as fast as an M1, not nearly as fast as an M1, actually, but significantly faster than an old Kentucky long rifle, which is its probably closest kin.
So what is the effect of one of these when, say, a Mongol horde charges a group of...
If anyone doubts the efficacy of that particular rifle, one of the 1632 people built one and fired it. It works.
Oh, yeah? Wow.
Yeah, Kevin Evans.
Oh. Kevin Evans built one and has shot it many times on the range. You load it with black powder, put a cap on it, put it in, and it fires. It shoots.
So the Ring of Fire series has contributed to actual firearm history now.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, maybe we'll use that come the apocalypse. So... You can't, with mass fire, basically, and with a gun like that, the days of the cavalry charged are numbered.
Yeah, yeah. It's got two major advantages. One, it can be fired from a prone position, which means you can fire it from a much safer position. And two, it can be reloaded much more rapidly for a limited number of times. Now, you can, depending on these... These chambers are not like a bullet. They're not like an M16 round. They weigh like 3-4 ounces a piece. You get 10 of these, you're talking several pounds of extra weight that you're carrying simply to carry these chambers. So you can't carry 100 rounds. You carry 10 rounds and a powder, essentially a powder horn. You load your 10 rounds. You carry them in a bandolier for 10 rounds. You've got rapid fire, but then you've got to reload them. Okay, so it's not a perfect system. It's what you can do.
Yeah, and it sounds kind of like a.
You don't have the technology. You know,
a similar effect of a like a Civil War revolver or something. All right. So what does a battle look like, technologically speaking? What weapons are brought to bear in when?
The AK-3s and AK-4s. The AK-4s have also a tube so that you can fire them a little bit faster. Basically, it's a little device that lets you change chambers faster until you run out of chambers. But it lets you shoot a little bit faster. And in Kazan, the enemy who is used to and expecting single-shot muzzle-loading weapons with a reload time of like 30 seconds to reload one, run into a weapon that has a reload time of like 3 or 4 seconds, maybe 6. Yeah, call it 6. If you're lucky, maybe 10 seconds. Maybe 6 rounds a minute would not be out of line for these things. And they come in to a bunch of people on walls. They fire off their whole army. These guys fire off their fuselage of rounds, and then they start reloading. And by the time they're finished reloading, the guys down behind cover, who they missed because they were behind cover, and their total target area was 4 square inches, have shot back 6 times. So for every person in Kazan behind the walls, the attacking army needed 6 times that number just to do equal trading of fire. And since the guys outside the wall had to be standing up to fire their guns and to reload their guns, they were standing up in the open after they shot their wad and basically getting decimated. And that's how they held Kazan, because the technology, even a simple piece of technology, can change the whole game until the other side gets it.
Mm-hmm. Well, what would be the best case and the worst case? What are the stakes here if... What kind of Russia would we see if our heroes win, and what are the what's the downside if they lose? What are we fighting for in Volga rules, in other words?
Yeah, if they lose, it's going to be a totalitarian state that makes Stalinist Russia look liberal, and if they win, you're getting something that's got the chance. Just the chance to turn into something rather like the United States of America.
Uniquely Russian flavor.
With a uniquely Russian flavor.
Yeah. Well, cool.
A state where there's a balance of, where you've got a federal government, but you also have state governments that have their own customs and that have rights, where the state governments have laws, so that there is that balance that Alexander Hamilton was so intent that America have, and that has served us so well for the past couple of hundred years, that there would be states, but and also a federal government, so that there would be a balance of power.
Mm-hmm. Step back from that for a second. Now the last thing that you two and Eric had out was the Alexander Inheritance, which is a really cool book. What are you working on a sequel to that? Is it done? What's going on with that?
We got about 40,000 words in it
written, I think.
Now that is another time travel book, but it's farther back, down back into the Mediterranean of in a cruise ship, right? Gets sent back to
the Queen of the Sea.
To the Mediterranean of Egyptian, who's the pharaoh at the time? It's
of Greeks, Alexandrian inherit. It's right after Alexander dies. It's the period called the Diadochi,
uh-huh.
And it's about the guys, the Alexander's general, and how his empire that he built, basically as a personality cult, came apart after he died. Our guys from the early 21st century arrive in Egypt, in Alexandria, Egypt, just 2 years after Alexander the Great has died, and they proceed to save Alexander's empire, maybe.
Well, what about Volga rules? Have we ended the sort of northern front, Russia front, crescent of tales, or?
I think there should be another one. I think because for one thing, I'm not sure how much snirking of the plot we want to do.
It's a very cool book. Love all the Russian, all the amazing Russian stuff from the 1600s that gets thrown in there, along with, of course, our uptimers trying to figure out who these weirdos are and trying to drive dirigibles. And my gosh, it's an amalgamation of wondrous stuff. The book is 1637, The Volga Rules by Eric Flint, Paula Goodlett, and Gorg Huff. And it's now at booksellers everywhere. Gorg and Paula, thank you so much for being with us and talking about it.
Thank you.
Anytime.
That was part two of a two-part interview with Paula Goodlett and Gorg Huff talking about 1637, The Volga Rules by Eric Flint, Paula Goodlett, and Gorg Huff. Part one is available on last week's podcast.
This is another entry in Alliance of Equals, a Liaden Universe novel by Sharon Lee and Steve Miller. Beset by the angry remnants of the Department of the Interior and challenged at every turn by opportunists on their new homeworld of Sherbleak and low on funds, Clan Corval desperately needs to reestablish its position as one of the top trading clans in known space. To this end, Master Trader Sean Yosgalen and Corval's premier trade ship, Dutiful Passage, is on a mission to establish new business associations and to build a strong primary route that links well with existing loops and secondary routes. But reestablishing trade and preserving the lives of the few remaining members of the clan aren't all of Corval's problem. Matters come to a head as Dutiful Passage, accustomed to being welcomed and feted at those ports on its call list, finds itself denied docking and blacklisting while agents of the DOI mount armed attacks on others of Corval's traders under the very eyes of port security systems. Traveling with Dutiful Trader on this unsettling journey is Paddy Yosgalen, the master trader's heir and his apprentice. Paddy is eager to make up for time lost due to Corval's unpleasantness with the Department of the Interior, but she is also keeping a secret so intense that her coming of age and perhaps her very life is threatened by it. And here is the latest entry in Sharon Lee and Steve Miller's Alliance of Equals.
Chapter 24. The Happy Occasion, Langlast Port. Sean exchanged cards with Marthimer Seert, master of the Langlast Technology Exchange. Master Seert had not precisely said that he was interested in antiquities, but he had not precisely been disinterested in the subject either, when Sean artlessly misunderstood his role. As it happened, Langlast had a vigorous culture of invention of new technologies and adaptation of existing technologies. They prided themselves on being able to improve any mechanical design brought to them, and also produced manufacturing designs upon request. Also, generic plans for a range of basic useful items, Master Seert had said. Base-level bots, cleaning, security, and the like, through your mid-level servers and house-minders. He'd given Sean an arch look here, the mention of old tech having come earlier. None one of 'em smarter than I am, never mindin' yourself, trader. Living units for all environments, all just smart enough. There's my own area now. One or two of my designs are fetching, I like to think, and there's others worth the look. Truth, it's likely the general plans'll be the most use to you. We'll provide you with a display, set it up in a corner of the booth. Them plans'll sell themselves. Seen it time and again. You come call on me tomorrow midday. I'll see ye balanced for your hospitality here today, show you round the shop, and let you have a look at the display unit. Is that done? Done, Sean said, and nodded at the card the man still held in his hand. There's a beam code on that. If you'll do me the favor of sending a confirmation. These receptions leave me quite scrambled. Master Seert laughed. Aye, I'll lay odds they do just that. I'm looking forward to our next meeting. And tell you now, bring your prentice, eh? You are very kind. Non, nothing kind there. It's the duty of experience to teach inexperience. So said my mother, and I find the same. Another comfortable laugh. If we don't train 'em up right, we've only ourselves to blame when they make hash in place of profit. Sean laughed softly. I agree. We both look forward to seeing you tomorrow. Master Seert bowed then, a peculiarly wooden bending at the waist until his back was straight and his face was pointed at the floor. It was a mercifully brief exercise, which Sean exchanged for a slight bow between business associates, as Master Seert straightened and moved away toward the wine table. Sean sighed. Thus far, the reception was going well. Indeed, now that he had a chance to properly survey the room, it would seem that they had managed to convene a crush. Caterer Hortensis stood at the corner of the wine table, serving as quantity control and, so he suspected, to enforce the local age law regarding the imbibing of spirits, while a helper wearing a long red apron over his white skirts brought out a new plate of breads and slipped it deftly into place. Paddy. Paddy was in the midst of an animated discussion with three respectably dressed port brokers. Even as he spied her, two of her interlocutors ambled off, like Master Seert, to the wine table. The third moved closer to Paddy and bent somewhat as if to put a question. To the outer eyes, Paddy was tense, but no more than one might expect of someone hosting her first reception. Sean opened a tight road from him to her and caught the brittle edge of her headache. He considered rubbing it away, but even as he did, shadows moved at his elbow, and he turned to bow to a new pair of Langlast merchants.
"The family finances are sound, sir," Paddy said, which was no more than she had heard Father answer to other like inquiries at other ports. "Of course, there were expenses involved in our relocation, and of course, now that we are settled, we are looking for new partners and new routes to business. There is no expectation at all that we shall founder, as trade remains at our core." Hurst Plichette nodded gravely and sipped from his cup.
"That's pretty said, that is. Nor I won't hide from you that I expected to hear the gloss. But I'm a serious man, trader, and gloss won't hold me. Have ye numbers, statistics, it might be said, to reassure me?"
She tried to concentrate through the flickering pain in her head. It seemed that Broker Plichette wished to be given proof that Corval would endure forever. Aunt Anthora could, perhaps, prove the future. Priscilla might, indeed, prove the future when the necessity was upon her, but apprentice trader Paddy Yosgallen lacked their advantages. She took a breath. "These are questions better put to the master trader," she murmured. "May I bring you to him, sir?"
"Oh, no, never put yourself to such trouble. I've spoken to the master trader, and stood aby and listened to him. He's an apt lad, and none dummy, I'll wager. If I ask it hard enough of him, he may give me a nugget more, that the head of family might have allowed him to say, no disrespect to the master trader or the Da at home. But yourself, trader, you've got nothing to tell me but what you know, see it? And I already got from you that there's something not quite what it ought to be."
Her head was going to explode, gods. She dare not close her eyes and access bored rest, not with this man watching her so closely. Patty raised her head and met the broker's eyes. "Sir, you ask me to prove the future. I have no such abilities. I can only point to our record, the past, and extrapolate from that. Those records are available, and I would be pleased to send them to you when I return to the ship. May I have an address capable of receiving a download? I should warn you that our trade history is long and the download large." He was clearly amused.
"Now, there's plain speaking and a generous offer alongside it. But, trader, much as I agree with you that none can scry tomorrow, sure it is you'll agree with me that the past is gone and puts no weight on the future."
"No," Paddy said, around the jagged pain in her head. "There we disagree, sir. If the past has no bearing on the future, you would not be asking me for a guarantee that I'll wager you yourself would not give were our roles reversed. Indeed, let us test it now, as we stand here together. Can you provide me with proof that Langlast's textile mills will not founder and fold some short while after we have concluded an agreement?"
"Why, trader, Langlast's mills have endured these 200 standards and more. What do you imagine might cause them to fail, all of them to fail, now?"
"My imagination is not at issue, sir. I seek assurance for the future, and you offer me the dead and dusty past. How am I to make a rational decision unless I have hard facts?" He threw his head back then and laughed so loudly that the rest of the room quietened as all eyes turned toward them. If Hurst Plichette were the least bit discomfited by the attention he had gathered, it did not display itself in a return to seemliness. Indeed, he laughed the harder and slapped his leg in addition. Patty felt her ears growing warm and her head pounding fit to burst. A large, warm hand landed lightly on her shoulder. She turned her head to look up into Father's face. He was smiling his trade smile, which was nothing at all like his real smile, and his eyes were rather cool. "Are you quite well, sir?" he asked, and his voice was cool too.
"Oh, I'm well, and weller too," the broker said, his hilarity subsiding to a point where he might speak.
He raised a hand to wipe his eyes and gave Paddy a wide grin.
"Trader, it's been a long time since I've been so masterfully sassed. All honor to you, and I'll be offering you my own key."
Two fingers dipped into one of the pouches suspended from his belt and brought forth an info key, which he offered to her across the palm of his hand as if he offered her his dirk.
"Come to the textile hall tomorrow, if your schedule allows it, and ask for me by name. There are some items I think you might find of interest. If you do, Well then, we two will come to an agreement made in the present, with neither the past weighing over heavy on us, nor the future only black. Thank you, Paddy said, taking the key gingerly from his palm and tucking it into a jacket pocket. Have you a beam code? My schedule tomorrow. On the key, trader, he said, grinning anew. All of it on the key. Thank you, she said again, father's hand still gentle on her shoulder. My pleasure, trader, and it's truth as I say it. He bowed then, the stiff-backed salutation that seemed to be common here. Paddy bowed as to a business associate, and father inclined his head. Broker Plichette straightened and strode away toward the back of the room and the wine table. The rest of the guests seemed to take a collective breath before they turned back to their interrupted conversations. Now, I wonder, did you sass our guest? Father asked, for her ears alone. She sighed and did not lift a hand to rub at her forehead. I fear that I must have done. He was pushing me to prove that Corval's fortunes would remain firm. And I, in order to show him how insupportable his demand was, I asked that he provide me proof that the Langlast mills would not fail. She shook her head, waking bright blades of pain. I should not have done so, she murmured. He wished to make some point about Corval's relocation, and my head was... She stopped, biting her lip. She had not meant to mention her headache. Father's fingers exerted pressure, and she sighed, relaxing somewhat under the warmth of his touch. May I assist you with the headache, trader? It was a small thing, she thought, only a headache, scarcely worthy of a healer's attention. Yet, it could have as easily gone the other way, the matter with Broker Plichette, and the passage come under the frown of the Langlast Port merchants entire, for she remembered how the others had deferred to him and cut short their own game. If you please, she murmured, it's the stupidest thing. Not at all. The day has scarcely been free of stress, of which I will speak more in a moment. Close your eyes, child, and take a deep breath. She did so and felt a subtle embrace, as if everyone who loved her had wrapped her in their arms at once. A cool breeze wafted sweetly through the hallways and closed rooms inside her head, cooling the pain, loosening knots, and straightening things she had not known were awry. The breeze subsided by degrees so small that she did not mark its cessation, and only knew with an intensity that brought tears to her eyes that her head no longer hurt. She cleared her throat and took a moment to gather herself. Thank you, she said, turning to face Father. She surprised what might have been distress on his face, gone before she could be certain. You are quite welcome, trader, he said in a light, teasing tone. Please do not hesitate to request assistance from this office again. It is, I assure you, my pleasure to serve. Now, attend me, child. We have an appointment tomorrow to meet with Master Seert of the Langlast Technology Exchange. He particularly requested your attendance. You, of course, are to visit the worthy textile broker, and we shall doubtless gather more invitations before this event is concluded. Constrained as we are to wander as a threesome, I hope you will not find it too tiresome to tour the port with me. Not at all, Paddy said, perhaps a little too loudly. Certainly, her enthusiasm was genuine. Excellent. What I propose is a small tour after the reception is over.
of the portion of the port between the happy occasion and our hotel. We will dine, you and I will compare our various appointments, and we will speak together before seeking our beds. Tomorrow morning, assuming all proceeds as it ought this evening, we shall begin in earnest. Does this schedule find approval with you? Yes, sir, it does, she said, smiling and eager. Her excitement was plain to a healer's senses. And so was the cold adamancy of stone. Admiral Bunter, this is Hazenthal Norfellium, piloting Terrigan. Am I heard? There was delay. Naturally enough, the Admiral was very nearly at the jump point. Pilot Norfellium, you are heard, came the Admiral's voice. The Admiral's new voice, as she thought of it, so much more energy and strength came with the words. I would speak with Pilot Mentor Jones, she said, if he is able to come to the comm. Tolly Jones is not permitted comm, Admiral Bunter said, and added, after a small hesitation, if you wish to record a message, I will ensure that he receives it. Why is he not permitted comm? Hazenthal asked. Is he a prisoner? He is... Admiral Bunter's voice faded, then came back, though not quite as strong as previously. He is a pirate. A pirate? Hazenthal stared at the comm, utterly dumbfounded. Tolly Jones, a pirate? He fought pirates when we were partnered and ensured the safety and order of the port. He is no more a pirate than... She knew a moment's qualm regarding those persons who might be considered by the Admiral's still stringent reckoning to be pirates and had a happy inspiration. Tolly Jones is no more a pirate than you are. Tolly Jones withholds from the Lyar Institute a valuable item which rightfully belongs to the directors of the Institute. He knowingly withholds this valuable and is thereby a pirate. That had a strong feel of a lesson learnt by rote, thought Hazenthal, no stranger to such things. However, time was too short to enter into a protracted debate with a stubborn AI, even had she a hope of prevailing. She was an explorer, and as such, more able than a common troop to enter into debate. However, she had observed Tolly and Inky at their work, and was able to concede, without dishonoring her own skills, that she was no mentor. If Tolly himself had not been able to argue the Admiral free of this lesson. Pilot Norfellium, I urge you to record quickly if you wish to leave Tolly Jones a message. I am nearing a mark. Yes, she said, and for a long precious minute could think of nothing to say. Pilot, your message. She took a breath. Tolly, it is Haz. I have your back. Another breath. Message ends, she said. Recorded, Admiral Bunter said. Out. The calm light went dark. Hazenthal contemplated it for a moment, then touched the switch that activated the pin beam. To Captain Miri Robertson, she said. Jalaza Kazone, Shorebleak, from House Guard Hazenthal Norfellium on detached duty. A message arrives for you, Tolly Jones, the Admiral said. Do you wish to hear it? Yes, he said, which might have been a little brief, but the Admiral didn't seem to notice. Or maybe he did, because there was no acknowledgement of his preference, so that Haz suddenly saying his name made him jump in his seat. Tolly, she said, sounding solid and on task, just like Haz always sounded. I have your back. Damn it. It brought tears to his eyes, that simple statement. Like everything wrong was suddenly set right, 'cause Haz had his back, which was foolishness. Big and tough she might be, and a soldier bred, born, and trained. All that meant in the end was that she was a little harder to kill. That was all it meant. Damned if he was going to have Haz's death on him. Damned if he was going to let them hurt one short, bristly brown hair on her head. Admiral, please relay a message to Haz. He wondered what message he could possibly send that would turn her from her purpose, even if the Admiral agreed to. Recording, the Admiral stated. I suggest brevity. We are about to transition. Right. He took a breath. Haz, it's Tali, he said, his voice clipped and hard. Go home. I don't want you, and I don't need you. Message ends. He closed his eyes then and leaned back in his chair, sick to his stomach, his palms cold and sweaty. That ought to do the trick. Kick her a good one right where she was most vulnerable. In the temper. That was one place. In the heart. That was the other. Always trust the training. Sean moved to the juice display and accepted a glass from the attendant. He would have rather had wine, but the casks were overseen by caterer Hortensis herself, and he had no wish to find himself admired at the moment. Paddy. Her gift was straining at the stony restraints she had placed upon it, the assault of so many emotional grids, some, as he had noticed himself, quite distractingly loud. The stress of responsibility, how could one not be stressed as the host of one's very first reception? He remembered his first reception with a thrill of nerves even now. Though he had been only a very little older than Paddy was now, and already trained in healer protocols as well as in bed manners. Well, he had done what he could for the moment. The absence of the headache alone would lessen her general levels of stress. He'd also performed a very basic sort to calm her, and placed a block, a measure in which he put not much confidence, considering the weight of power he felt building, like a thunderhead towering over his child's head. He wished he had a more thorough understanding of the structure Paddy had created, and how precisely those walls had been formed, and with what materials. However, a public reception was no place in which to perform an in-depth examination, and he did believe that his small efforts would hold well until they arrived at the hotel. Once they could be private, more appropriate measures could be applied. Briefly, he considered sending her back to the passage while he and Vanner remained on port, very briefly. Paddy would feel, and justly, that she was being denied an experience vital to her growth as a trader. Sean sighed and raised the cup to sip juice. His mouth puckered and dried, which was, as Priscilla might say, a blessing in disguise, as he could scarcely breathe for a moment, much less gasp aloud. The sensation passed, leaving his mouth feeling perfectly clarified and clean. Carefully, he lowered the cup and looked inside. Blue juice. He sighed. Paddy had warned him, after all.
That was another entry in the complete audiobook serialization of Alliance of Equals by Sharon Lee and Steve Miller. And that's it for the podcast. Thanks to Audible.com, to Bane intern Charlie Smith, and to podcast theme composer Ruth Judkowitz. And the end pieces of the breadloaf conception of the universe containing time slices for the Big Bang and for the final yummy end crust after everything is done, plus thanks and major adulation for Paula Goodlett and Gorkov. co-authors with Eric Flint of 1637 The Volga Rules. Please join us next time here at the hammering heart of science fiction and fantasy. And keep reaching for the stars.